In our outline, we come today to Roman numeral 21, continental rationalism. We're going to study a particular school of thought. It may take all of today, I'm not sure, that is identified during this period of time with the continent of Europe, and thus it's a European or continental emphasis upon the rationalistic or rational approach to the theory of knowledge. Epistemology is the term we use for the theory of knowledge, and a rational epistemology stresses that there are self-evident truths from which we can deduce substantial conclusions about the way things are. The rationalist has this in common, though they will differ with one another. They hold this in common, that we can begin with truths which are not verified by the senses, not verified by going out and observing the world, but are verified internally. They are rationally self-evident. And these truths are not just arbitrary, are simple, if you will, definitional truths, but they will tell us substantial things about reality. We can deduce from them the nature of the real world. So the rationalists all held that conviction, and they secondarily, we could say, they have in common a search for certainty in philosophy, taking mathematics and geometry as the ideal for knowledge. The rationalist doesn't want mere probability, doesn't want mere usefulness in terms of what we call knowledge, but wants certainty. And the model for certainty is geometry or mathematical reasoning. That's the ideal of knowledge. So I put up here on the board, rationalism, remember, in the broadest sense, is committed to self-evident truths from which we can deduce the nature of reality, and the model of mathematical certainty for what will count as what we know. The first major continental rationalist, the mother of all rationalists, we might say, was René Descartes. His dates are 1596 to 1650. René Descartes was a Frenchman. You can tell that from the name, I take it. And a Roman Catholic Frenchman who had a Jesuit education. He was in Paris for quite a while, traveled, served as a gentleman soldier, and we know that early in his life he disdained scholasticism. Scholasticism is the term that's used for medieval Aristotelian philosophy, and he thought the scholastics were something of a waste of time. In the year 1619, Descartes tells us he had three successive dreams, which he took to have come from on high. In gratitude, he pledged a pilgrimage to the shrine of the Virgin. And in these three successive dreams, it was delivered to him what a new scientific method for thinking would be. We'll come back to that new scientific method. But I want you to understand that Descartes, though he was a rationalist, believed that he had a mystical experience that provided the foundation for his rational philosophy. Kind of ironic, isn't it? In 1629, he settled in Holland, where he felt that there was greater freedom of thought. And in 1637, published a work that is considered by most scholars the beginning of modern philosophy. The work is entitled Discourse on the Method, and it goes on and on, usually abbreviated to Discourse on Method. And the title itself tells you something about modern philosophy. Modern philosophy is focused on and pivots on the whole question of method. How do we know what we know? Modern philosophy is pervasively epistemological in orientation. It's not simply enough that somebody has a great scheme for reality or can tell us how we should live our lives. We want to know, how do you know that? On what basis? What warrants your conclusions? And so with the scientific revolution that we've talked about, and also a great disdain for scholasticism, getting away from the tradition and authority of the church, naturally enough, in this period of time, in the early 1600s, the beginning of modern philosophy, the stress comes to rest on the issue of theory of knowledge. How do we know? 1637, Descartes writes his theory of knowledge, if you will, his discourse on method. In the year 1650, he died at the Swedish court of Queen Christiana. And not only is Descartes the father of modern philosophy in the sense that he brings right to the surface and addresses directly this issue of method or how we know what we know, but Descartes is the first and the major of the continental rationalists. His answer to how we know what we know is quite different from what we'll find in Locke, Berkeley, and Hume, who take a completely different approach, but later for them. Descartes now. Descartes had a supreme confidence in the human intellect's ability to solve all human problems. An optimistic belief in the universality of reason and the adequacy of reason to solve man's problems. So you want to make sure you get into your notes this upbeat, positive, confident attitude that the human intellect is capable to solve our problems. There's a universality to human intellect or reason, and it's an adequate one. Indeed, all men, according to Descartes, have a native power adequate to know reality, and reality is fundamentally rational in character. All men have this native power to understand a rational reality. Why then are there a diversity of opinions among men? And obviously, if men have diverse opinions, there's going to be ensuing social problems. How can we take care of all the conflicts? How do you account for them, and how do you resolve the conflicts, these social problems, and the differing, conflicting opinions? Descartes believed that these resulted from people not having the opportunity to develop their intellectual powers properly. Our problems stem from a lack of appropriate development of intellect, and therefore the key to enlightenment and the key to responsible citizenship, the key to understanding the world properly and solving our social problems is education. Descartes is not the first one in the history of Western thought to have proposed education as man's salvation. We can go all the way back to Plato. Those of you who have taken the ancient philosophy course remember that Plato held that nobody willingly does what is evil. When people do what is evil, it's because they misperceive it to be good. And so what we have to do is educate them, and if they know what is good, then they'll do what is good. In a somewhat parallel fashion, Descartes felt that the reason why people have different opinions and we get into all these social conflicts is because they haven't been educated. They haven't disciplined their minds to follow the proper method of thinking. So Descartes is a modern man in that sense. He still wants to have an optimistic view of human reasoning, an optimistic view that all people are in touch with a common rational reality, and that if there are problems and differences of opinion, they can be resolved through education. Okay, so much for Descartes' autonomous confidence. Secondly, you want to note his desire for certainty. He wanted to be able to come to conclusions about which he could be certain. He didn't want mere opinion. He didn't want just this conflict of subjective views and feelings. He wanted certainty. What can I know for sure? And he wanted to know that. He wanted that certainty apart from authority. In this sense, he would not agree with Hobbes at all. I don't want certainty just because the Leviathan has imposed a uniformity of thought on people. And he wanted certainty apart from theology, apart from the authority of the church, and apart from the authority of God speaking in his word. That isn't to say that Descartes repudiated scripture. This is the difficult thing for us who study the history of thought, is that we'll run into people who are saying things, you know very well the end of the story is going to be horrible. He's starting something here in this idea of putting theology aside that's going to lead to the rejection of theology and people being atheistic and so forth. But for Descartes himself, he always wanted to be a good Roman Catholic. So he wanted to have theology over here and he wanted to have his philosophy over here. In that sense, he's very much like Occam. Philosophy must be separated from theology. My reasoning ability must be separated from faith. Or, if you will, my reasoning ability becomes the authority for my reasoning. Now, I want you to notice there's a huge shift now that's taking place. Reason is not just God-given intellect put to use, but reason becomes the judge of all things. Reason will be an authority, not just a tool for Descartes. And so he had a desire for certainty that was apart from political authority, apart from theology. To put it very simply, reason became for Descartes a secular and autonomous instrument that he exalted to his epistemological authority, to the position of being the authority in his theory of knowledge. And where is this kind of reason best exemplified? Descartes found it exemplified in the new scientific method. Descartes looked about at the advances in science in his day, and he saw, now that's reasoning for you. And I just want to give you a little aside here that is not irrelevant, but not directly on Descartes. Please be aware of the fact that throughout the history of philosophy, when people have spoken of reason, this is one of the most common words in philosophical discourse, when they've talked about reason, they have meant a plethora of different things. And that's what always makes it humorous to me when we see what I consider hack philosophers and quack apologists referring to reason as their authority. You know, well, we're going to go to reason. I always want to say, reason understood in what way? In the Lockean sense, in the Platonic sense, in the Cartesian sense, in the Hobbesian sense. I mean, there are so many different concepts of what reason amounts to that today it's almost the sign of an amateur ability in philosophy when you hear people say reason is going to be our guide, because you've got to say much more than that. Now, Descartes in his day thought he could appeal to reason, and he loved what the natural scientists were doing. But it turns out that what the natural scientists understood as reason was much different than what Descartes would take reason to be. And we could get very sophisticated here if we were in a graduate class, but let me just, at an introductory level, remind you that for Galileo, reasoning meant, look in the telescope, stupid. Go out and see with your senses whether, you know, your mathematical calculations match up to your experience. Descartes, on the other hand, is going to understand reason not as sense experience. He considers that somewhat confused and leading to doubt. Reasoning for him is more the mathematical model of thinking. All right? So the aside here, which is important, I want you to bear in mind, is that there is no common understanding to this word reason. And remember, just a few moments ago I told you, there's a difference between appealing to reason as man's intellectual ability, the tool of thinking, and appealing to reason as though it is its own authority. Okay, so as a Christian, somebody might say, I see this all together in our debates over apologetics in our day. You know, I'll have somebody say, well, you don't believe in the use of reason. How are you supposed to respond to that? Well, does that mean I don't believe in the use of the mind? Well, that's absurd. If I thought that, I wouldn't have gone to graduate school in philosophy. I do believe in thinking. In fact, many people get frustrated as to how intellectualistic, if you will, the defense of the faith can be. But I certainly don't believe in appealing to reason as my final authority. I think this tool is used under the authority and the direction of God, because the beginning of wisdom and knowledge, according to Proverbs, is the fear of the Lord. So yes, I don't appeal to reason as ultimate, but I certainly use reason. But when you say, I don't believe in reason, and apparently you do, you think reason is this authority, I still don't know whether to agree or disagree, because I have no idea. Is reason the goddess of reason at the French Revolution? Is reason the great, you know, metaphysical principle of Hegel? Is reason the sense experience of Galileo, or the internal mathematical reasoning of Descartes? And we can go on and on and on. Please don't forget, though it's an aside, this is an important observation in the history of philosophy. Back to Descartes, though. He has confidence in human reason. He has a desire for certainty. And he thought that this proper method was somewhat exemplified in the scientific procedures and advances of his day. The key to thinking would be the proper method, being rational. Do make sure you get in your notes the irony, though. This rational method was discovered in a mystical dream. Descartes sought a universal, infallible method of reasoning. And as I've indicated, he was impressed with mathematical certainty. What Descartes did then, you could put in your notes, is that he generalized the mathematical method to serve as a universal instrument for reasoning about anything. This may be the first time in your whole life you've ever been forced to draw this distinction. But you must realize that not all of the human sciences use the same methods. So most of you have had a geometry class in your high school background, I'm sure. And you know something about the method of geometric reasoning, okay? You begin with certain axioms, and you have theorems that are proved according to your axioms. And when you prove something, you go from one premise to another via a rule or an axiom that permits you or warrants you to take the next step until you finally get to what was to be demonstrated. And so you say, therefore, QED, this is what was to be demonstrated. Now, that is not the method of reasoning, however, that you find everywhere. That's not the way psychologists reason. They don't write down premises and start drawing all their mathematical warrants and conclusions and so forth. It's not even the way biologists reason. And so what is unique about Descartes here, of course, we're back at the beginning of the development of particular sciences and so forth, but back in that day, in the early 1600s, Descartes wanted to generalize the mathematical method or the geometric method of reasoning as a universal instrument for thinking about anything at all. And what's crucial is for you to realize that unlike many people in our day, or many people subsequent to this, Descartes believed that mathematical knowledge tells you something about the objective and rational character of reality. That is, when you have mathematical insight, you have insight into the nature of reality itself, the objective character of the real world. Not everybody agrees with that. There is a large school of thought that believes that math is basically formal and not objective or substantial in its insights. That is, math turns out to be the way in which we manipulate arbitrary definitions. 2 plus 2 is 4, or better, 2 plus 3 is 5, and that's true because of how we define 2, 3, and 5. Okay? If it turned out that 5 was defined in the way that we define 6, 2 plus 3 would not equal 5. It would equal 6. Okay, so many people would tell you that math is arbitrary. Math is only formal. It tells us the relationship, you know, of our definitions. But it doesn't tell us about the character of reality. Descartes believed that math gave insight into objective reality. So that when we start with the premises, whatever premises we start with, on the model of math, he's not going to begin with a mathematical premise, but on the model of math, Descartes says, when you start with a premise, you're beginning with a clear and a distinct idea, something that you can't doubt. Okay? The idea is not fuzzy, it's not ambiguous, it's distinct, it's clear, and it's internal. Of course, this will be both the strength and the downfall of this theory of knowledge. It begins with clear and distinct ideas, self-evident truths, as I put it earlier. Truths which are not verified by the ambiguities of human experience. Now, we all have to agree with Descartes, don't we, that our human experience is ambiguous. It's uncertain. When I perceive things, I can't always be sure of my perceptions. Okay? Have you ever awakened in the middle of the night and because your eyes had not focused properly, you saw an object as closer to you or further away than you thought? That perception was confused, wasn't it? Okay? And if you've ever had the privilege of open heart surgery when they give you morphine as your painkiller afterwards, you can't really count on the things that you're feeling and seeing on morphine. I can tell you that from experience. But then again, how did I tell you that from experience? Well, I remembered it, right? But then again, memory's not always clear. And I don't know whether this is just because I'm getting older. I hope that you young people can identify with this. Every once in a while, I can't be sure whether I told somebody something or whether I just thought about telling them something, and it was such a clear, I have to make sure to do this. Did it get done? Do you ever have that, or is that just for old people like Dr. Monson? Never. It's always clear and distinct. Well, you have confused memories of some sort, whether that's a good example or not, you know. In fact, empirical psychological studies have shown that often what we consider memories of our childhood are reformed views of what actually took place. It's rather fascinating to see how memory itself, it's not like we deliberately sit there and say, I'm going to reform, you know, what happened back on the playground on that day and so forth. But the way in which we recall things is not always exactly the way it was. You have confused memories, you have confused perceptions. Sometimes you can't even be sure if you're remembering a perception properly and so on. So Descartes, you see, had that much going that he realized that not everything is clear and distinct. But if you had something which was clear and distinct in your mind, this internal certainty that that's something you could start with. Okay, an aside in the way of criticism. Isn't that ironic? This method, which we've already seen historically, came to Descartes in a mystical vision. This method wants us to begin, for the sake of certainty, with clear and distinct ideas. But clear and distinct ideas are what? They're internal. And what's that going to mean ultimately? Since they are not public and objective, they are going to be subjective. You come to me and you tell me you have a clear and distinct idea of something, and I challenge that, and you're going to say, I'm sorry, for me it's clear and it's distinct. No doubt about it. So here is this desire for certainty, which is ultimately resting upon a foundation of subjectivism, an internal experience. Not that we don't have clear and distinct ideas. I've already told you, you can certainly see a gradation between that fuzzy dream you had and a memory which is kind of messed up and something which you are very clear on and very distinct about right now. I agree with Descartes. There is that difference. But since that difference is not public, not something put out there in the domain where it could be verified, it's going to end up being subjective. And I think that is an irony for a rationalist to have this subjective infection in his theory of knowledge. I kind of like that sentence. Write that down. Irony for a rationalist to have a subjective infection in his theory of knowledge. Okay, let's contrast Descartes with Hobbes real quickly before we go on in our exposition. Hobbes believed you can start with certain definitions, and from those definitions you could bring down conclusions. But according to Hobbes, you can have one set of definitions over here that brings this set of conclusions, and a different set of definitions arbitrarily that you begin with that bring different conclusions, and the only way to settle the difference is to appeal to the political power. Regimentation of thought by the state. Okay? So Hobbes says, sure, you can begin with your, quote, clear and distinct ideas, but what you get to is just one arbitrary set of conclusions over against another arbitrary set of conclusions because you've just begun with different definitions. Descartes did not hold that view. Descartes believed that if you begin with a clear and distinct idea, you can deduce from it conclusions which are objectively true. Not just the arbitrary way of thinking that you've chosen and that somebody might regiment, but that all men should come to the same conclusion. In this sense, Descartes was more in line with Plato, indeed even with Aristotle to a certain extent, and the medieval philosophers. I'm going to give you 4 points that are crucial to understand his commonality with the history of rationalism as a philosophy. He believed in the reality of universals. He didn't think they were mere names, just arbitrary definitions. He thought that a universal principle told you something about reality. Secondly, he believed that the final test of truth was the principle of contradiction. The final test of truth is a question of logic. Are you saying something which is internally contradictory or not? Thirdly, Descartes derogated perception. He believed that though you might use your senses in contact with the world, you can't count on them. Sensation or perception is of less authority and certainty or reliability than our reasoning ability. And then finally, and this is crucial, with Plato and Parmenides and a number of ancient Greek philosophers and the medievals, Descartes believed that whatever is real is rational. Whatever is out there, whatever the nature of reality is, it will be rational. Now let's learn something about, philosophy in general, but apologetics in particular. Did Descartes prove that the real world is rational? Is that something that was subject to demonstration, or something that he went out and he proved by sensation or observation? Did Descartes prove this, or does this have the status of a presupposition? You see, this is something which informed his approach to philosophy. It was not the result of his approach to philosophy. So, with Descartes and with others, notice that he always has something that he's presupposing, even when he's trying to get down to rock bottom about his method of thinking. His method of thinking itself, what he chooses as a method of thinking, has presuppositions to it. We have in our day and age, again in the Christian community, apologists who believe that there are certain presuppositions that everybody, that all men share. Ironically, I happen to agree with that. I don't think they're the presuppositions these apologists want to appeal to. They'll want to appeal to things like the law of non-contradiction and the reliability of sense experience. Yeah. I realize that they are popular and that people will follow that, but that is just embarrassing as a comment in the history of philosophy. Those presuppositions are not held in common by all people. And moreover, those things that that people take as their presuppositions are not themselves proved by their methods. And Descartes is a beautiful example. We can understand, and we might even agree with Descartes, that the real is rational. Because we as Christians believe God is rational, he's made the real world, and so forth. But the point is, that's a presupposition. That's not something Descartes proved. So again, the four things that we see in Descartes that he holds in common with the long history of rational, or the school of rationalism in epistemology: the reality of universals, the principle of non-contradiction as the test of truth, the derogation of perception or sense experience, and the view that the real is the rational. Over against Descartes, you would have the medieval nominalist and the medieval voluntarist. Certainly, Hobbes would not buy all of those presuppositions that I just laid out for you. For the medieval nominalist and voluntarist, and like the empiricist of the modern age, the emphasis is not upon the rationality of reality, but the factuality of reality, which is a way of saying the emphasis is not upon what you can reason mathematically about reality, but upon its, you know, sensation, its factuality. It's more important to go out and observe, check the facts, than it is to stop and think, to rationally reach a conclusion. Well, anyway, having made sure you understood the distinctiveness of Descartes here, how he stands over against others and yet in line with a very venerable school of thought, or a train of thought in terms of how we approach questions, let's go on and see that Descartes believed that mathematical reasoning was the basis for a grand metaphysical structure. A structure that was systematic and included man, the world, God, and values. Okay? Descartes didn't use this language, but what we today would call a worldview, he said, could be brought about. You could develop a worldview, a system for where man and God and values in the world all have their proper place. You could develop a system by using this mathematical reasoning. Okay, enough introduction. How are we going to begin this system? How are we going to develop it? Well, Descartes says we need a clear and distinct, or what we might call self-evident, beginning principle, don't we? What will that be? We need a self-evident first principle, a metaphysical absolute from which we can generate, by this mathematical reasoning process, a full system of thought, which will be an absolutely certain science of reality. Hey, you can't fault Descartes from, you know, it's not as though this guy was a lackey. I mean, he wanted to accomplish big things. I may not approve of the way he did it and the assumptions and so forth, but Descartes said, look, I want to begin with certainty. I'm tired of all this conflict of opinion, tired of scholastic reasoning and so on. I want to begin with something that you can't doubt, and then we'll move by steps, like in geometry, discursively, step by step, reasoning through deduction what the nature of man is, the world, God, value, and all the rest. I want to get a completely rational worldview. And that's all going to begin with a first principle. How are we going to get that first principle? Descartes, and this is what he did in 1637, he proposed what we now call methodological doubt. Methodological doubt. We must methodically, systematically doubt everything we can possibly doubt. Suspend all of our beliefs which are dubitable. Suspend every belief that you could have any doubt about until you arrive at a sure starting point. And once you get that sure starting point, once you found that, from it, the other beliefs that you had suspended previously could then be deduced in a somewhat geometric style of proof. Okay, so methodological doubt. This means doubt everything except that which cannot be doubted. So let me ask you, can you doubt that today is Monday? Sure. I do this the story every once in a while. I get the day of the week wrong or the date wrong. We can make mistakes about what day it is. Well, how about this? Can you doubt that you're now wearing a shirt? Can you? Well, sure, because you probably had dreams when you were wearing that shirt in the dream, and you weren't really wearing that shirt. So this might be a dream. It's possible. Can you doubt your perceptions? Well, you'd better if you've ever seen the railroad tracks, you know, merge up, you know, ahead, or if you've seen, you know, a body of water on the hot pavement as you're driving in the summer and so forth. Yeah, you can doubt your perceptions. Your perceptions may not be right. You know, you may not be wearing the shirt that you think that you're wearing. It may not be the day of the week that you think it is. Well, there's a lot of things you can doubt. Can you doubt God's existence? Well, certainly can. Some people not only doubt, they absolutely repudiate God's existence. So that's a controversial point. That's doubtable. It's dubitable. What is the one thing that is beyond doubt, according to Descartes? The one thing that is beyond doubt is this. I must surely exist in order to doubt that I exist. I must surely exist in order to doubt that I exist. And so we have this famous aphorism in the history of philosophy, cogito ergo sum. In Latin, I think, therefore, I exist, or I am. I think, therefore, I am. If I'm thinking, then I have to exist to be thinking. Yes, I'm being very doubtful about everything, and I might even doubt my existence. But if I'm doubting my existence, then it must be me who is doubting that it's me. The one thing you can't get away from then is that you exist. That is the most certain metaphysical principle of all. I exist. And how do I know that I exist? Because when I try to doubt my existence, I still have to exist to do the doubting. So cogito ergo sum is often delivered as dubito ergo sum. I doubt, therefore I am. Because I'm doubting, or I'm thinking, then I have to exist in order to do that. Now, I don't know, many people are taken in by that and see great profundity in it. And you might, but I'd like to encourage you to be philosophical about this. Remember, I'm not questioning whether I exist when I do this. I'm questioning the validity of this reasoning. And you have to, this is another lesson, and as you grow up as philosophers, you have to be willing to criticize things even though you agree with the conclusion. Because in philosophy, remember, Descartes stressing what? Proper method. Okay, so I sometimes, even in theological circles, I'll argue against somebody who holds the same conclusion I do because I don't think that he's proving it properly. And so I'm not saying we should all now just come to the conclusion that we don't exist. That's not the issue. But has Descartes proven that he exists? I think, therefore I am. If the premise is I think, and the conclusion is I am, does anyone see anything suspicious about that premise? Well, the premise assumes what? The I. That is, Descartes wasn't proving anything. He was simply begging the question. Somebody says, well, how else could you have it? As Bertrand Russell once put it, Descartes should have said, there is thinking, therefore I exist. And once you do it that way, you see that that's not a good argument at all. When Descartes said, I think, he already took for granted what he was supposed to be proving, his existence. Everyone with me? And in that sense, as many like to say, cutesy style here, Descartes could have as well said, I think, therefore I exist. Because he's building the I, the existence of the self, into his premise. I stink, I think, I am. So in the end, I don't think this is all that great a philosophy, but nonetheless, we're back to the history of thought. Descartes felt that from this basis, a whole philosophy could be developed. And you need to get this into your notes. For Descartes, he would begin with the self, that is the metaphysical absolute. He would begin from the self, that which is certainly known, and from the self he would prove the existence of God, and from the existence of God he'd prove the existence of the physical world. Okay, so Descartes' line of reasoning is from the self to God, to the world. And I'm putting this up on the board because I want to draw some contrast for you. Before those contrasts, though, note this. For Descartes, the beginning point is man, or the individual man, the self. This is why we will call Descartes' philosophy a man-centered or self-centered philosophy. Okay, so Descartes moves from the self to God. Now, which philosopher in the history of thought that we have just recently looked at would completely disagree with this idea that I first begin with the autonomous, independent self, man, and then I move to God? Thank you. John Calvin. Calvin's opening of the Institutes is the very repudiation of what Descartes is doing. He says you can't know yourself without knowing God, and you can't know God without knowing yourself. So this very idea that you can begin here and move here, and especially that you begin with man of all things and then move to God, is anti-Calvinistic. By the way, Calvin didn't propose the opposite, did he? He didn't say, let's begin with God as though I don't exist and then move to me. He said, in knowing myself, I need to know God, and in knowing God, I need to know myself. You can't begin in some kind of vain, speculative realm of theology and then move to you as a person. And so Descartes is anti-Calvinistic here. But I want you to notice something further. He moves from God to the proof of the world. Now, who's that the opposite of? You have to go back to the Middle Ages. Who is the grand philosopher of the Middle Ages? Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas says we move from what we know about the world to God. Okay? So, if you will, this part of my diagram is anti-Calvinistic. This part is anti-Thomistic. If nothing else, I hope that shows you the structural uniqueness of Descartes' philosophy. Man-centered. I think, therefore I am. I don't know about God for sure, but I'm absolutely sure about me. This is, you know, the pop psychology, I'm okay, you're okay. And then people make fun of it and say, I'm okay, I'm not so sure about you. Well, Descartes, you see, had that insulting approach to God. He said, I'm okay, and God, you come in next. I'm not so sure about you, but I am sure about me. Very man-centered. Confidence in reason, confidence in man, education is going to be the salvation of man, and so forth. So I just want you to make sure you have a sense of the character and the thrust of Descartes' philosophy. And he is not only someone who stands against our Calvinistic approach to philosophy, but he also stood approach to Aquinas. Okay, we've already proven man's existence, or so Descartes thought. I've critiqued that, and I expect you to be able to critique it as well. But let's look at his proof of God's existence.
According to Descartes, the existence of God is, quote, manifest to anyone who desires to think attentively on the subject. According to Descartes, anyone who will think attentively, if you just use your reason properly, it'll be manifest to you that God exists. And what is his proof? Descartes says, nothing less than God is adequate as the cause of our idea of God. Descartes says, I have an idea of God. And from his idea of God, he's going to prove the existence of God. Now, who might that remind you of? Although the comparison is a false one, I think. Who does that sound like in the Middle Ages? From the idea of God, I'll prove the existence of God? Anselm, what we call the ontological argument. From the definition of God, Anselm thought it was necessary that God existed. We won't go over the ins and outs of that. I'm sure Dr. Crick would enjoy explaining it to you better than me. But Anselm said, if God is the being than which none greater can be conceived, if God is the most perfect being, and perfection involves existence because that which exists is more perfect than that which does not exist, then the very definition of God shows you that God must exist. If he is the greatest being, and greatness includes, it's greater to exist than not to exist, then God must exist. So Anselm says perfection implies existence. The word here implies must be underlined in your notes. Perfection implies existence. Descartes is also going to argue from our idea of God to the existence of God, but not by implication. He's not going to say the notion of God or the concept of God implies his existence. Descartes is going to speak psychologically here. He's going to say the idea of God must be caused by something. And nothing is sufficient to cause the idea of a perfect, infinite being than a being that is infinite and perfect. Now, there's something attractive about this argument. Philosophically, I'm going to tear it, I hope, to shreds in a second, but let's try to sympathize with this for a second. Descartes says, okay, I have an idea of a tree. Now, what could account for that tree? Well, the tree could. But I could also have an idea of a tree if there were no trees. I could be confused and, you know, and have an optical illusion, or I could have a dream and so forth. But the point is, whatever causes my idea of the tree is certainly as great as the idea of the tree itself. The underlying assumption in Descartes' thinking is this. There's at least as much reality in the cause as there is in the effect. There is at least as much reality in the cause as there is in the effect. And so how much reality does the idea of God have? That's the effect, okay? Here's this effect in my head, this idea of God. Well, how much reality does God have in thought? Well, he's infinite. He's perfect. Well, what could cause the idea of infinity and perfection? Only that which is as real as the effect itself. And so there must be something that is infinite and perfect that caused the idea of an infinite perfect being in my thinking. So you're all with me? Notice that Anselm said the concept of God, the definition of God, implies the existence of God. Descartes is not arguing that way. He's saying the idea of God needs a cause, and only that which is as great as what you're thinking about could cause what you're thinking about. So nothing less than God is adequate as the cause of my idea of God. Now, Now, if you were inclined, I mean, I don't want to disprove God's existence, obviously, being a Christian, but if you were inclined to philosophically analyze Descartes' argument here, is it any better than the argument for his own existence? Well, first of all, he's assumed that reality is rational, right? Somebody has, you know, maybe the gumption, they certainly have the prerogative to challenge that. Maybe reality is not rational. And moreover, maybe we don't need a larger system in which to validate every finite truth that we have. There's a finite truth in my head that God is infinite, but do I need an infinite system in which that finite thought is validated? The real is the rational, you see, has built into it the notion that you have to have the entire system in order to have any particular truth. And so Descartes, though he's veiling this in psychological and theological jargon, is really just repeating to us that he thinks the real is the rational. So I've got a rational idea. It must be what? Real. There must be a reality behind this infinite, perfect God. He rests upon the notion of causality in his argument. This is another criticism. But is causality a rational relationship? Is causality a rational relationship? Or is reality merely a spatio-temporal reality or relationship? Because I goofed it up, I'm going to say this again. Causality. We're asking about causality. Is the causal principle a rational principle, or is it a spatio-temporal principle about what follows what in the order of our space-time continuum? Well, most people would say causality is spatio-temporal, but if you notice here, Descartes is using causality as a rational relationship. Well, in addition to those criticisms of his assumptions, the one that maybe is the easiest for you to follow is this. Descartes assumes that there's at least as much reality in the cause as there is in the effect. Okay, so we can put it this way. If we want to be charitable, Descartes, you have proven the existence of God as long as your premises are reliable. And what are his premises? Well, I'm not going to put it as strictly as I'd have to in graduate school, but it goes something like this. I have an idea of an infinite perfect being. There is at least as much reality in the cause as there is in the effect. Nothing but an infinite perfect being could cause this idea. Therefore, God is real. The infinite perfect being is real. One of the premises in this kind of slipshod way of putting the argument, one of the premises is there's at least as much reality in the cause as there is in the effect. And we have the right to ask, Descartes, how do you know that premise? How do you know that that's true? By the way, even if I'm inclined to believe that, I'm not. I think it's a very confused way of speaking. But, you know, you might be sympathetic to that. But as you do analysis, you must say, how do you know this? Don't take anything for granted. Isn't that the Cartesian call? Don't take anything for granted. Doubt everything. Force a proof for everything. So, Descartes, I'd like to know. How do you know there's at least as much reality in the cause as there is in the effect? How could Descartes know that? What could he appeal to? How about this? Somebody says, I appeal to experience. Experience? Let's assume that experience did teach you that in a few instances. There are a lot of counter instances. Is there as much reality in the mosquito as there is in the malaria that the mosquito causes? Is there as much reality in the source of the cancer as there is in the cancer that's cut out? I mean, we can think about examples that don't seem, at least from an image point of view, don't seem to say there's as much in the cause as there is in the effect. But let's just forget all of that and grant Descartes what he needs. He has a few clear instances where he can show us there's at least as much reality in the cause as there is in the effect. But the question is going to be, how do you know that's true universally? If Descartes appeals to it as a universal principle, then he must have a basis that would make it universally true, not just in a few instances. Let me teach you something about reasoning here, because this is a major mistake, and unfortunately Christians embarrass themselves doing this, even as non-Christians do. You might imagine somebody could say, well, Descartes has shown a few cases of this. He has the right to assume it until you show otherwise. He has the right to assume it until you show otherwise. Is that offering a warrant for the universal principle? Or is that just saying that we aren't going to fault you? That is, it's like you have the freedom to go about doing that. That's different from intellectually warranting that in every case there's as much reality in the cause as there is in the effect. All I'm getting at here, sports fans, is that Descartes has an assumption about reality here, and it's an assumption which must be universal to make his argument work. And he has no basis for that universal assumption. So I don't think that he has proven God's existence any more than he's proven, the salient word is proven, any more than he's proven his own. I do believe Descartes existed. I believe I exist. I certainly believe God exists. But I don't think that given his assumptions, he's proven any of that. Let's go to the next step in the argument, though. What do we know about this self that God, that Descartes has proven? We know that he's a doubter. Right? I doubt, therefore I exist. So let's begin with that. What do you say about someone who doubts? Someone who doubts is imperfect. Someone who doubts is limited. Quite clearly, someone that is limited and imperfect could not be the guarantor of its own existence. And so the certain existence of an uncertain self demonstrates its dependence for existence on something more than itself. Let me say that again. Descartes is certain of his existence, but he's certain of the existence of an uncertain self. Because he's a doubting self. And therefore he must depend upon something else for his existence, something more than himself, something that's beyond himself. Descartes' doubting existence, that isn't to say the existence is doubted, but his existence as a doubter therefore calls for the perfect being that exists, and that's God. Descartes has proven that he exists, he's proven that God exists, and now he's proven that God exists as the perfect being, the undoubting, the certain being. God is perfect. Descartes argues that God is perfect because Descartes is not perfect, and yet Descartes certainly exists. His existence could not then be its own guarantor. He must exist as imperfect because of a perfect being, God. And now we have a very clever argument that if God is perfect, we've proven the self, we've proven God, and now we've proven the perfection of God. If God is perfect, then the material world of bodies can be proved. How's that? Well, if God is perfect, he is good. Those of you who are doing advanced thinking might put in your margin, there's a questionable leap there from one concept of perfection to another, but nevertheless, if God is perfect, then that includes moral perfection. All right.
Now, something about ourselves. We're inclined to believe that things exist outside ourselves. You know why we're inclined to believe that they exist outside ourselves? Because we can't control their behavior or their appearance by mere thinking. Okay? I believe that this book exists outside me because I can't think it away. See, if it existed internally, if this was just my imagination, I'm holding the book up, if this were just my imagination, then I could think it away, right? I could just think differently and it would no longer be here. But lo and behold, I open my eyes and it's still here. I can't think this book into existence and I can't control its behavior.